This is the Alien UFO Podcast, episode 15, and I'm your host, Simon Bowen. My mission here at the Alien UFO Podcast is to investigate all things that are part of the wider UFO phenomena. I'm looking at UFO sightings, alien abduction, historic cases, and other related events. This is the free version of the episode. The extended episode is 19 minutes longer than this version, and to get access to the extra 19 minutes, you can join the Alien UFO Podcast Patreon campaign. And when you sign up for $7.50 a month, you get an extended episode every week. And for $4.50 a month, you get an extended episode every month. And there are now 15 extended episodes available, but the back catalogue will grow every week. And the Patreon episodes are ad-free and are released 2 days before the free versions. You can become a patron by going to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, and the links are in the show notes. And please check out my other podcast. It's called The Past Lives Podcast. There are over 200 episodes. On The Past Lives Podcast, I look into evidence of the afterlife, such as near-death experiences, children with past life memories, mediumship, deathbed visions, and other phenomena. And if you enjoy this podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. This week I'm talking to Graham Rendell about his book, UFOs Before Roswell, European Foo Fighters 1940-1945. Graham has written articles for The Debrief, UAP Media UK, and Shadows of Your Mind magazine. He's also one of the members of the UAP Media UK. Hi Graham, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Hello Simon, thanks for the invitation.
I saw your book. It's called UFOs Before Roswell, European Foo Fighters 1940-1945, which is something I've always been fascinated by, but I've never seen a book like yours which goes into so much detail, because it's always been like just a little note on the side for other UFO books, hasn't it?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I suppose if you go back to the late 1970s, early 1980s, when I first started reading UFO books, it was, as you say, a footnote. And you were lucky if you got a couple of lines about the Foo Fighters. And if you were really lucky, a paragraph. But there was very little detail. And there's a reason for that. I mean, we can go into that in more detail if you like. But there were definitely reasons for why that was the case. But to me, even at the time, it just seemed like there was this kind of gap in the reports from the Second World War that just didn't seem to be covered in any great detail. It leapt from the ghost flyers of the 1930s across to 1946 with the ghost rockets in Scandinavia, and then to Kenneth Arnold and so on. And there just seemed to be this gap that didn't seem to be filled by anything. And I was wondered why that was the case.
And you seem to be really well qualified to study this, because you say in the book, for 50 years you've been an aviation enthusiast and a World War II kind of student. So it's not just like you're a UFO nut, you've got all this other background as well.
That's true, yeah. I mean, I started off being interested in aeroplanes from an early age, from about the age of four. So, you know, my mother bought me FX kits to keep me quiet when I was a kid. And, of course, the instructions had little potted histories about the aeroplanes that you were building. So you could learn about, in a few paragraphs, what made the Spitfire tick for the Lancaster bomber on the Messerschmitt 109. So I got into sort of learning about World War II really early and about aeroplanes as well. So, yeah, and then when I got into UFOs, about 8 or 9 years of age, reading about those. And then I got into German secret weapons as well through my interest in World War II. And of course, with the Foo Fighters, all this just came together. It was all these three strands of the aviation, German secret weapons, and UFOs. And it was a perfect storm almost. And yeah, I mean, I'm not an expert on any of those things, you know, by any means, but it was a good opportunity to write about things I did have some interest in and I did have some knowledge about.
And what I can see in the book is that you know how to do the research, that you track down the original squadron's records, the pilot's records, if you can, and try and confirm as much of the stories as you can.
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's really important. It's one thing writing about, you know, what apparently has happened back then in terms of UFO reports, like you would do for the 40s and the 50s, but you have to back it up with documents. Otherwise, it can be almost hearsay. And it's then your spin on how you interpret it all. But when you can actually go back to what they were writing about in official documents. So this is not just somebody saying, oh, I saw this. you actually look at the intelligence reports and some other reports and the war diaries, you build up a picture of what's going on. And it's much more important to get the words that were being said at the time rather than somebody's interpretation of them, say, 80 years later.
So can you tell us why we have Sean Cahill writing the foreword? Because he was witness to the events of the 2004 Nimitz Tic Tac encounter.
He was it.
So why is he in this book about, you know, the Foo Fighters from the Second World War?
Well, first of all, I was introduced to Sean by a mutual friend, Dan Zetterstrom, who's known as The Signal on Twitter. He's an artist, and he's just come back from Colombia, where he was with one of his colleagues looking at various strange phenomena out there. So he knows quite a lot. He knows people as well. He knows Sean through a convoluted story, which I won't go into. But he introduced me to Sean, and I asked Sean whether he would sort of consider writing a foreword for it, because I thought it might have some kind of an interest, because bear in mind the US Navy encounter, you mentioned the 2004 Nimitz encounters, involved aeroplanes, although he was on board a ship when he saw it. And I just thought it would be nice to have a kind of link between this modern day encounter, which effectively involved a dogfight between US Navy jets and something strange. But similar things happened in World War II. So I thought, you know, I might be able to get some kind of link here between somebody who was involved in that experience in 2004 and the things that happened in World War II. Little did I know that Sean's father had been a US Army Air Force airman flying in B-17 Flying Fortresses from England during the Second World War, and he'd had his own encounters. So he was, you know, really, really up for writing a foreword about the Foo Fighters, because it did sort of, you know, fit neatly into his father's experiences. And his father hadn't really owned up, talked about these kind of things much, but he had done it on one occasion, and it had really sort of intrigued Sean about as to what was going on. And then when he realized that, you know, I was writing a book on this, and I'd come up with this on this information that I've found out about the subject, some of which has never ever been published before, then he jumped at the chance to write the foreword. So I'm really pleased he did.
One of the sentences that stood out to me in the book is that you said, "I have attempted to explain what the Foo Fighters were not." So it's not like you're trying to prove what they were. It's just, if we can work out what they're not, that gives us a better idea of what they could be.
That's true. And that's the kind of approach I've always taken. Even the early days when I was looking at, you know, reading UFO books when I was a kid, it struck me that when people were writing these books back then, some of the authors, and only some of them, but they would come up with these kind of information about sightings, and then it would be, oh, there's these lights in the sky, therefore they must be aliens from Zeta Reticuli. This kind of, I mean, that's a bit exaggerated, but it was that kind of logic. They were leaping way above what you could extrapolate from, you know, quite almost mundane sightings. And they were trying, as you say, trying to prove, you know, something that nobody really knows. So therefore, I always adopted the position where it's better to try and work out what, you know, to rule things out. It's a bit like Sherlock Holmes, isn't it? You know, you rule out all the things that it can't be, and then you're left with the truth kind of thing. Now, I'm not an expert on UFOs by any stretch of the imagination, and all I can do is just try and rule a few things out, and then it points people in the direction of things that it might be. And I think that with the knowledge I had of German secret weapons, I could probably rule out with, you know, to a great degree that it wasn't, you know, the Foo Fighters weren't those, and the other things that were seen in World War II weren't those. There weren't some kind of super secret disc-shaped German technology that some people keep talking about, but there's no evidence for. So the things that I could rule out was relatively easy based on what I knew about the subject. And to tie that in with the Foo Fighters. But then you're left with, well, what are they? Now, that's a different question altogether, and it's not something I'm qualified to be able to answer. So I go so far in the book to say, look, it's not this, it's not that, it's not this thing as well. But saying what they are, you know, I'm not prepared to do that, because that's a quite an easy way to destroy credibility. Everybody knows of people in the past who have said X, Y, and Z about UFOs, and it turns out that they're probably wrong, or it's turned out that they have been wrong, and, you know, and people have these kind of pet conspiracy theories about this, that, and the other. And usually you look at them and you just think, really? You know, and then it gets to the position where people have these kind of entrenched views on certain subjects. But then when the information changes because people find out new things, they're then having to dance on the head of a pin to try and defend the position that they've previously taken, because, you know, the information changes and everybody else's attitudes change toward the subject, but they're left dangling because they've put, you know, bet their house on this particular sort of you know, this kind of explanation for something, and it might turn out to be wrong. So it's better just to sort of keep quiet about it and think, well, I don't really know what they are, but here's what they're not. And to me, that just sounds a very sensible sort of, you know, sort of route to take for this whole thing.
So would you describe yourself as a kind of open-minded skeptic?
There's a chap called Micah Hantz, I'm not sure whether you know, he's a podcaster from America, and he used to call himself an informed skeptic. He's open to the fact, to the possibility that things are, well, alien or exotic or unexplained, but he's also, you know, open to things being explained in slightly more mundane terms. Now, that's me as well. You know, I'm not a true believer by any stretch of the imagination, but then again, I'm not a debunker either. And if somebody came along tomorrow and could categorically state a perfectly good reason for everything that's been going on, to which proof which held out to the nth degree, and people could go, you know, collectively, oh yeah, that's what it is, that's fair enough. I'm not going to, you know, cry myself to sleep kind of thing at nights because there's no exotic explanation for UFOs. Equally, if somebody comes along with some really exotic explanation, then it's, oh, wow, you know, yeah, okay, we'll get some more of this. We'll dig a bit deeper into it and see what else we can find out. So it's more a journey that I'm on, and I'm just going where the information takes me, where the data takes me, where the truth takes me. You know, wherever that ends up, who knows? But it's an interesting journey all the same.
These Second World War UFOs, these Foo Fighters, yeah. Could you describe what would be a typical encounter, or would you say there isn't one?
Well, there isn't one. I mean, if you go to the phrase Foo Fighters, so we'll explain a little bit about that. It's probably helpful for your audience. Because UFOs, just to use that term, were seen throughout World War II. And they weren't just seen in Europe, for the information in my book. They were also seen elsewhere. So they were seen in the Pacific Theater operations as well. But that's a different, that's beyond the scope of the book I wrote. But if you look at the Foo Fighters as terms of a phenomenon, they were strange lights that followed aircraft. And it basically, the phenomenon supposed to have started, according to the legend, around about the end of November 1944, in a kind of area of land of eastern Belgium, eastern France, western Germany, from end of November till about sort of March, April 1944, before the end of the war, and affected one particular US Army Air Force night fighter unit, the 415th. And from the information that was available for about 50 years, which I mentioned earlier about the reason why there wasn't that much information for this subject, the available information on the kind of the encounters or the sightings that you mentioned there, you know, to describe them, came from an American Legion magazine article that was published in December 1945, and it had about 9 different cases listed, and it was written by somebody who was an aide to General Hap Arnold, who was the chief of the U.S. Army Air Force during World War II, and this lieutenant colonel, a guy called Joe Chamberlain, had been sent to the front to look at logistics and things, to see how smoothly operations were running for the U.S. Air Force, for the U.S. Army Air Force, sorry. And he'd been what we call now embedded with the troops, and he'd stayed with some of these units and stayed with this unit, the 415th, and he'd heard from the night fighter pilots and crews what was going on. So to describe one of these typical encounters, you have a light which either appears or comes up from near the ground and follows or sits off the wingtip of an aircraft. And it doesn't matter how much the pilot tries to shake this apparition off his tail or off his wingtip, it just sits there. And then it flies off on its own accord after a few minutes or several minutes. And there's nothing they can do about it. They don't know what it is. They think it's a German secret weapon, but it's nothing. It's not operating in a hostile manner. It then just flies off. And it happens over the course of several months, night after night after night. Now, according to the original report in the American Legion magazine, and then repeated in UFO book after UFO book through the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, and even into the 90s, these same reports were regurgitated from that magazine in 1945. But actually, when you look at the original intelligence documents and war diaries from not just that unit, the 415th, but from the 422nd, who were based in eastern Belgium, then you'll find that those sightings actually predate November 1944. They go back as early as September 1944. And that's just the American side of things. So you've got these sightings, as I say before, which are just lights following airplanes. But actually that phenomenon had affected the RAF, the Royal Air Force, as early as March 1942. And there are, again, records in the intelligence documents and in the squadron diaries and documents like that, which detail various encounters with strange lights or things that were described as rockets, because they had no other frame of reference. They didn't know what they were looking at. And because they knew the Germans were developing things like this, that was an easy kind of term to use, because, well, what else would they be? So there's some of these rockets zigzagged in flight, or sometimes they followed the aircraft for a long period of, for a long distance. So there were some strange things going on. But essentially, the things that were classed as Foo Fighters later on in the war, around about the winter of 44-45, had been seen much earlier. And although the documents go into specifics from about 1942 onwards, that's the only information I had to hand when I was writing the book. Since then, I've been down to the National Archives of London, which I did last October, and I found a whole load more documents which date from 1941. So they were seeing similar things then as well. So it goes for quite a long distance during the war, quite a long period of years. It's not just that kind of neat, cozy little time frame from end of November 44 to the end of the war, like most of the UFO books, since the war have said. It's a much more widespread phenomenon in terms of time. And actually, when you look at the areas where it happened, it's geographically widespread as well. There are cases from Norway right down to the tips of Italy, from the Bay of Biscay off France, right across the Eastern Front. So they cover everywhere.
Would you say that some of these sightings, the lights, could behave in a way that was beyond human technology? Would that be right? Like they were just so fast or manoeuvrable?
So, yes, for both reasons, and certainly because they were beyond the capabilities of the German technological base at the time. To give the one example, I mentioned before about March 1942, and there was a Polish crew who were flying Wellington bombers with 301 Squadron, who were based in Lincolnshire in England at the time. And they'd come back from a raid on a place called Essen in the Ruhr in Germany. And they were flying out over Holland. So they were flying out to cross what they call the Zuider Zee, the inland sea of water north of Amsterdam, which was much bigger at the time because they hadn't done a lot of the land reclamation projects at the time. And this large kind of disc-shaped light appeared behind the aircraft. And because they thought it might have been a German night fighter because it was this bright light, the pilot told the tail gunner of this Wellington bomber to open fire at the light if it got close enough, which the gunner did. But the bullets did nothing to this light. The bullets have one in every 10 rounds as a tracer round. It's a kind of fluorescent light round that so lights up in the sky so the gunners can see where his bullets are going. So it's helpful for aiming at night. But the bullets were going into this light, but nothing was happening. And if that had been a German night fighter, it would have been shot down because the bullets were going into it. But then it just decided to move round to the side of the aircraft and sat off the wingtip for a while. And of course, at that point, the tail gunner could turn his turret and he could open fire as it went round to the wingtip. And also the nose gunner of this Wellington bomber could do the same. He could open fire at where it was. But again, nothing happened. Now, this can't be any kind of German aircraft because they're firing bullet after bullet into it. And then it flew off to the nose of the aircraft and kept stationed off the nose of the airplane, where this aircraft's flying through the sky at about 180, 200 miles an hour. And this thing's just sitting, keeping station a couple of hundred feet off its nose. And then all of a sudden it just flies off into the night sky. Now, to me, that's no kind of German technology. And I don't know about you, but, I would have thought that you probably think, well, there's something weird, seriously weird going on here. And it wasn't just that crew either, because they mentioned that the aircraft behind them in the group of aircraft that were going for this target, coming back from Germany, they had seen a similar thing as well. So you know, that story alone should make people sit up and take notice. One, because it just surpasses any kind of technology that the Germans had or even had thought about back then. But even it surpasses what you have nowadays, because something that's invulnerable to machine gun fire would have to be armor plated. But how's it going to fly? It just seems to defy all kind of logic, that story. But it wasn't the only thing that was open fire on World War II. There were several other stories about things that were, you know, opened fire on by gunners and bombers that just seemed to be, you know, impervious to machine gun fire.
And was that the crew where I think they mentioned that despite getting a lot of banter and bullying from other crew, they stuck to their story? They wouldn't be beaten down into admitting it wasn't real.
The one you've mentioned there is based on a sighting that happened over northern Italy by the crew of a Lancaster from 61 Squadron. And they were flying to Turin to attack the engine factory there. And over the Alps, so this is like the kind of the northern Italian, the Italian Alps, they saw this 200 to 300 foot long, well, I think they call it a Zeppelin type of craft because that's what it resembled. But it was flying up a mountain valley the second time it saw it. And no self-respecting Zeppelin would have been airborne at that time of the war. You know, it was too dangerous. And why would you be flying over mountains at nighttime? It didn't make any sense. And this thing had lights along the side of it in any case, which a Zeppelin wouldn't have across the air bag or the gas bag kind of thing. So it didn't, none of this made sense. And when they got back to base, they'd actually reported this. And they'd had, as you said, they'd had ridicule and stigma from their squadron colleagues, but they stuck to their story. And they passed the intelligence people passed the information on, not just from the squadron, but up to the group level. So that's their immediate superiors. And they had this report passed on to Bomber Command for more kind of analysis, saying, look, you know, the crew are sticking to their story. But it was a thing that where the crews would come back from missions, and the first people they'd always speak to in the debriefing session they always had when after they landed were the intelligence staff. Every squadron had an intelligence officer or more, and they were their first line of defense about, well, what information have you seen? What were the flat defenses like? What were the night fighters like? Did you manage to drop your bombs on target? Did you see anything else unusual? This kind of questioning. And that's when they would say, well, yes, we'll have this light following us. And a lot of the time, the intelligence officers, because they didn't know a huge amount either, they were just almost a kind of clerk for recording information to pass it up the line. Their reaction sometimes was, you know, have you been drinking? You know, it was like kind of laugh this off. You know, what are you talking about? Are you trying to pretend that you're going insane so you can get yourself off flying duties? It was this kind of thing. And it got to the point where some crews just didn't bother reporting it because they knew how much stick they would be in for. Whereas some, yes, they stuck to their stories and kept on saying, look, we've seen these kind of things. There's another story from the Western Desert in 1943, in spring 1943, 73 Squadron flying Hurricanes on night intruder missions over the German lines to attack targets, lorries, parks, and fuel depots and all this kind of thing behind the front lines. And one by one, their crew pilots started seeing lights doing the same thing, sitting on their wingtips, following them, all this kind of stuff. And they were laughed at. One by one, however, the ones who were doing the laughing saw them themselves, to the point where just about everybody in the squadron had actually had an encounter or more with these strange lights.
So it seems obvious that it couldn't be German, because if they had that sort of technology, why didn't they just attack? They could have dominated the skies, couldn't they?
Exactly. The lights themselves make no sense. So if you go back to the intelligence documents from the Royal Air Force from 1942 and the ones I found from 1941 last year, they did a lot of analysis on these lights that were following bombers. And it wasn't just the fact that they were following them for a few minutes or maybe 5 minutes at a time, 10 minutes at a time. In some cases, and this is documented in the reports, one crew said they were followed for 50 miles, another one said 100 miles, and one said 250 miles. Now, that's some distance to be followed. And it's not a case of they were trying to, you know, you try and put yourself in the mind of a Luftwaffe night fighter crew. If they were following a bomber, then why were they doing it on the way to a target? Because, okay, they might be trying to find out which target they were going for, but the Germans had a very effective ground network of radars and your controllers to direct their night fighters to the targets. It was very, very sophisticated. That series of what they call boxes, where one aircraft and one box of sky, and as soon as a bomber flew into it, that's when they directed the aircraft towards the target. And that's how they tried to shoot down as many of our aircraft as they could. Because at the time, we were only sending our aircraft in ones and twos, different times, different routes. They weren't going in a big stream to the target like they did later in the war. So it was much easier for the Germans to work out where they were going and to shoot down. There was no need to follow them for mile upon mile upon mile. And actually showing a light in any case didn't make any sense from a military perspective. Why would you advertise your presence? Because you'd be invited to be attacked by either by the gunners on a bomber or by another RAF night fighter, because those aircraft didn't exist. So it didn't make any kind of sense to show a bright light, because you might as well just paint a target on your aircraft saying, shoot me down now. It was crazy.
Yeah, there's that. That's weird, isn't it? Because you would assume if the technology is that good, they could fly without lights on. So it's almost as if they're trying to draw attention. They want to be seen.
Well, yes, but it makes no sense from a German perspective.
Yeah.
To be, look, here I am. But from any other perspective, from something else, something more exotic, then, well, who knows what the motivation is there or what the kind of motive is. I can't put myself into the mind or something else or whatever was going on. All I can try and say is what they weren't. And I don't believe they were German night fighters, because they didn't act the way German night fighters performed. The idea of German, they would find the best, the German night fighter crews would try and find the best kind of firing, attacking position to shoot down a German bomber. First of all, before they had technology, they would creep up behind it and slightly behind and slightly below, and then fly upwards and shoot with a nose cannon at the back of the aircraft or at the fuel tanks. They actually then designed an upward firing gun called, it was called Jasmus in English, Schwarzmuser. And it was a gun that was pointed upwards at about a 45 degree angle. And all they would have to do then was fly underneath the bomber and fire upwards at the fuel tanks underneath the engines. And it was a devastating weapon. But you didn't have to have lights to do that. And in fact, because you were getting quite close to the aircraft that you were attacking, the best thing to do was not to have lights at all, because it invited a counterattack from the gunners or on the bombers. So, you know, having burning lights didn't make sense. Now, there is, some people have said, well, yeah, they had lights in the radar equipment that the radar operator on the aircraft had. And that is true to a certain extent, but these were diffuse lights, because one, you didn't want a really bright light that would blind the pilot, but also two, the radar operators were behind hoods usually, because it made sense not to show lights, to advertise a presence. So none of this makes sense. And yet in the reporting of the intelligence reports that the RAF produced, you see these reports of light after light following aircraft. And they did this analysis, and they counted up each month how many of these kind of occurrences there were. And some of them were explained as aircraft, but they couldn't work out what type of aircraft they were, which seems strange, because in other cases, when you see the squadron diaries, the gunners knew exactly what type of aircraft they were shooting down or they were attacking them, because they did aircraft recognition tests a lot during their training. So, you know, they were very, very clued up on what was around at nighttime, whether it was a Messerschmitt Bf 110 or a Junkers Ua-88. You know, they knew what these aircraft looked like, but these strange lights, they didn't know what was behind them.
And were these UFOs, I don't know what to call them. Should we just call them Foo Fighters? Is that all right?
Well, yeah, you might as well, yeah, because I use that phrase, you know, quite liberally through the book just to describe what everything was, because it was all different things, really. But that's a good phrase. It's a good phrase to use as any.
So were these Foo Fighters caught on radar? Were they able to track them?
Well, here's the thing. So back in those days, airborne radar was fairly primitive. The radar in a night fighter, the night fighter crew had to be directed to the bomber targets by ground stations, because the radar was too primitive on board the aircraft. It had a range of about 5 miles, maybe a little bit more, but you were getting in that kind of territory. So the German night fighters, from what people are aware, we don't know whether they picked up these things or not. if they were flying around, because those records aren't available. But you can see the records from the RAF night fighter crews and from the American night fighter crews based in Europe in, over the winter of 44-45. And you can see from the radar, the guys in these aircraft, because these were two men crews, the pilot and the radar guy behind him. And they can't pick these lights up. So these lights appear off their tails or off their wingtips, and these radars do not pick them up. Even the ground stations do not pick them up either. There's one particular exchange on the radio from an American pilot saying, well, we've got this thing next to us. Can you pick it up? Because we can't. And the radar guy on the ground saying, there's only you up there. So, you know, that basically answers that question. They didn't see them.
Did the Allies really take this stuff seriously? Did they spend a lot of time and money investigating this?
So according to the legend, I mean, I'm talking about what appears in the UFO books from 50s onwards until about sort of 10, 20 years ago. The reporting is that it was just this kind of momentary phenomenon, which didn't last very long, like 6 months at the end of the war. And they never really worked out what it was, and that was it. And that's what everybody has read for years. Now, behind the scenes, certainly early in the war, as I said, the Operation Research Section of RAF Bomber Command were interested because they didn't know what these were. And lights appearing behind an aircraft, well, if they were Germans, aircraft, then they were in an ideal position to shoot down bombers. And that's not very efficient for prosecuting the war. So they definitely wanted to know what was happening, because the idea is that you invent countermeasures to try and defeat whatever the Germans are doing, because, you know, it might be the next time this happened, they could shoot a bomber down. So there was always that fear. So the RAF were very interested, although they got to the point after about 9 months of work of trying to get all these facts and figures that they couldn't work it out. So they stopped doing the analysis. And then about 3 months later, they started again because it kept going. And then they give up for good because they just couldn't fathom it out. The Americans went through the same kind of machinations over the winter of 44-45. They had these sightings, they had all these crew reports, but nothing else to go on. There was no wreckage, there were no photographs, there were no radar traces. So it was all just hearsay, basically, from the pilots. And it got to the point where, because the senior command weren't doing anything, one of the intelligence officers from the main intelligence officer from the 415th Night Fighter Squadron, he compiled a report, and it was of 30 different sightings over December and January 1945. And he sent it off to his opposite number at a much more senior command, 12th Tactical Air Command. And they didn't know what to do with it. They'd had this information, but they couldn't fathom it out. They had no independent information themselves from anywhere else saying this is what they are. So it was a bit of backwards and forwards between the squadrons and these higher echelons trying to get to rationale the details to a point where at least some of them could be understood. At one point, the senior commanders went back to the squadron saying, well, which part of the aircraft are these lights attached to? So that was a complete misreading of the situation, because the squadrons had never said these lights were attached to anything. They couldn't even see anything, you know, beyond the lights. There was no craft. There were no aircraft. It was just lights. There was no form to them beyond just the light. So that was a complete misunderstanding of what was going on. But it got to the point where the senior commanders in Europe, in the US Air Force, or the Army Air Force, had this mass of information which didn't make any sense. So they asked the Air Ministry in London, the British Air Ministry, to get involved as well. Did they know anything? And after about a month and a half, so you're looking into mid-March 1945, the answer came back from them, oh, they're probably just measurement 262s, which was the German jet fighting. Now, that was a complete, again, misreading of what was going on, because when the Foo Fighters were seen in great numbers from about the end of November at 44, and actually earlier, the Germans weren't flying the ME-262 at night. That came along much later. So, and in very, very small numbers, and certainly not even in the places where these lights were being seen. So that explanation made no sense whatsoever, but that was what the Air Ministry came up with, and the Americans were quite happy with that, because to them that made sense, even though it didn't reflect the situation on the ground or in the air, so to speak. So, you know, take for that what you will.
And the authorities believe the Germans They tested experimental equipment under active service conditions.
Yeah. So there was still this line of thinking that the Germans had developed some kind of secret weapon. That never went away. And you have to remember that the Germans did invent Germans, you know, secret weapons. They had the V1 flying bomb, had the V2 rocket. Those things were considered to be causes of the Foo Fighters, but they were ruled out. You can rule out the V1 flying bomb because it didn't fly that high. It only flew about 3,500 feet. Some of these things were being seen at 19,000, 20,000 feet, 25,000 feet by British crews. So they couldn't have been those. The V2 rocket went straight up to about 50,000 feet and then tilted over to a 45 degree angle to do its trajectory to land on London or Antwerp or wherever. So it couldn't have been one of those either, because they didn't fly horizontally. And they certainly didn't chase after aircraft. Now, the Germans had a whole range of missiles, not just air-to-air missiles, but they invented those. They had air-to-surface missiles, but they also had surface-to-air missiles, although none of them were ever put into service because they couldn't iron out the snags. They had problems with guidance. They had problems with proximity fuses, with the engines that they were being propelled by. So there's all these things that kept them effectively on the ground. And these things weren't being tested in some of the places that these lights were being seen in any case. So that can be ruled out. The Germans invented a rocket-powered interceptor called the Messerschmitt Comet, but it only ever flew in the day. And yet some people were reporting seeing them at night, but they never flew at night. So what were these things, these little kind of bat-winged, black-looking craft that were seeing at night? Because there weren't anything the Germans were building. That was something else that didn't make sense. The Allied bomber crews, the RAF, were reporting seeing Messerschmitt 262s at night as early as September 1944. And yet the Germans didn't feel them until January 1945. And even in very, very small numbers. And they were kind of a very ad hoc lash-up of the day fighter. It had no airborne radar in them. There was one, you know, that they were desperately trying to convert two-seat trainers and trying to shove a radar in them to get them airborne to shut down our Mosquito fighter bombers. And that was the reason why they did it. But they still weren't very effective, and they were in very small numbers. You're looking at like 10 aircraft or so. The true night fighter, the Messerschmitt 262 night fighter, only came along at the end of March 1945, a couple of weeks before the end of the war sort of thing. So these things were not Foo Fighters. And then you get into the realms of the daft stuff, the so-called disc projects that the Germans were building, or these things that this Italian author called Renato Vesco, who wrote the book in the 1960s, came up with these aerial flak mines, one called Feuerball, one called Kugelblitz, and they were supposedly the cause behind the Foo Fighters. And yet none of these things existed. There's no proof ever to suggest anything like that actually ever was built, never mind flew, or used in combat.
So do we have any idea of what the Germans or the Russians thought, or if they saw them?
Well, here's the thing. So, Simon, when you look at the legend, and I talk about legend as in, you know, what's the kind of accepted wisdom for the Foo Fighters, long before I wrote this book, it's always said that the Germans saw them too. And you see that everywhere. Well, yes, you know, the RAF saw them, the Americans saw them, but the Germans saw them too. Proving that, however, is a different story entirely. There are some stories, and I've got them in the book, the ones I could find, but they're not backed up with official documents. And that's a difficult one to swallow, because it undermines the argument that they weren't German secret weapons. Because if they were, then you'd expect the Germans to know about it, and therefore they wouldn't see these things. But there is anecdotal evidence to suggest that the German pilots did see strange things. And there are testimony from the pilots concerned in a few cases that they did see some strange stuff. But there's no documentation. Now, there's a good reason for that. It's because a lot of the documents were destroyed at the end of the war. The Germans actually got rid of a lot of stuff that from their day-to-day communications and squadron information and all this kind of stuff. I think there's a whole year that might be missing from their from the Luftwaffe records. But some of the records from early 1945 do exist, and from the jet fighter squadrons. So you can see some of their records, but they don't really mention too much about these lights. So there's a bit of a mystery there. I'm sure they did see them, because I think that information has come from somewhere. And there is anecdotal information of German POWs being interviewed at the end of the war, or shortly before the end of the war, saying they saw things. But actually tracking down the individual accounts and backing it up with evidence, you know, that hasn't happened yet. And it probably needs somebody to go through the archives in Germany and with a fine tooth comb, somebody who's fluent in German and fluent in the military terminology that they used to try and track down this information. As far as I'm aware, no German researcher has done that yet. But I might be wrong about that. But I've never seen any of these accounts at all. So the answer to that question you've just posed there is, I don't know. As far as the Russians are concerned, well, you've got another entirely different set of secrecy. That information could well be locked away somewhere. Again, there are a few accounts, the ones I put in the book, but they're a mixture of pilots and people on the ground who saw strange things on the Eastern Front during World War II. You take the stories with a pinch of salt, maybe. Some of the Russian stories don't have much detail to them. There's nothing that you can check up, really, to say, oh, yeah, that's where they were. That was the squadron they belonged to. But that's a typical kind of Soviet secrecy from back then. However, there is one thing that did crop up during my research, which has never been published before, as far as I'm aware. And the RAF, who were basing bombers in Italy in 1944, were raiding targets in the Balkans. So in Hungary, Czechoslovakia, in Bulgaria, Romania, they were going after oil targets, the oil refineries. And during the course of a lot of these nighttime missions, certain squadrons were seeing things over those countries. So if you're looking at Eastern Europe and cases there, there were loads. I found loads of cases of strange lights and things that were classed as rockets, but couldn't have been rockets because the Luftwaffe and the Germans didn't use them in that part of the world. But these reports were being, documented night after night after night during 1944 and 1945 by a certain number of RAF squadrons. So things were happening out there as well.
So were they always harmless, the Foo Fighters? Did you ever come across something where they did something dangerous?
Well, here's the thing. So you don't know about the ones that didn't come back. That's obvious, don't you? So if a crew died because of the action of something, then we'd never get to know about that. So we'll never know those. As far as things hitting aircraft are concerned, there are isolated stories of things that were reported to either strike or to go through aircraft. So there's stories from the Balkans of things, of bombers being struck by strange rockets or things that were called rockets. What they were is a completely different matter. We don't know what they were. And there's a story that appeared in about the late 1950s, early 1960s, of an American daylight raid over Stuttgart in 1943, where a shoal of what were described as little black discs fell from the air and fell on these aircraft. And in one case, the story is that one of these things started to burn on the wing of an airplane. And then there was so flying through a shoal of effectively what I call in the book hockey pucks, would be a dangerous kind of proposition. But of course, the same thing apparently happened in Italy as well in 1944. And there were other isolated cases of strange things being dropped on aircraft or dropping out of the sky on aircraft. Now, the Germans did experiment with dropping bombs on aircraft formations. That much is documented. But it wasn't very successful. But these things didn't look like bombs. It's not something I'm prepared to say that's definitely a Foo Fighter. But it was very strange. And it was just another one of these kind of phenomena that nobody's been able to explain. If you look through all the German kind of descriptions of weapons, you can't find anything about these. You can find things about the aerial bombs they dropped. You can find things about what they call the parachute cable mines that they dropped on aircraft, which, again, weren't very successful. We even developed that called the PAC, the parachute aerial cable, during the early part of World War II, but it was useless. It didn't work, so we dropped it after a month or so. But the Germans tried to experiment with later in the war. But these things don't account for the stories that are in the histories. And they're not just histories like the stories from pilots saying, oh, I saw these shows of black discs. They actually appear in the US squadron diaries as well, and in their official records for the reporting of what happened in the missions. So it's not just a pilot or a gunner saying, oh, I saw these strange things. It's actually in the records as well.
Were they seen in the Pacific?
They were, yes. Now, this is beyond the scope of the book, so I haven't looked deeply into these stories, but they follow similar lines. So they were, a lot of the time out there, they were called Balls of Fire. They had a slightly different name. But they followed B-29 flying Super Fortresses. They followed other aircraft. There's pictures on, you'll find pictures on the internet of Japanese aircraft with these strange blobs next to them. Now, I don't know whether these pictures are true or true or not. I don't know whether they've been faked or whether they're defects in the film. But when you see pictures of Foo Fighters, they're the ones that keep getting shown. Now, I say I've got no idea of the provenance or the context of these pictures, but yes, things did happen in the Pacific from about 1942 onwards, right to the end of the war. But and they are in the documents as well, so they can't. These stories are available, and for a future book, I may well write about those. I have started writing one, but it's an early days, and that's probably going to be a few years in the preparation, because I think the RAF side thing isn't as easy to get the information from, because there weren't as many units out there in terms of RAF bomber squadrons, and the American records are a bit harder to go through. They're certainly harder to obtain. They're not as easy just to find as the RAF squadron records were for me, bearing in mind I'm not American. But I can get them. They're easy enough to obtain. They just takes a little time. And then they're not as easy to go through when you get them. But the people at Maxwell Air Force Base in Alabama, who look after the historical records for the U.S. Air Force, they were great in terms of finding things for me when I was doing the research for the book. They were absolutely brilliant.
So are there any reliable photos of Foo Fighters?
No, there aren't. That's a simple answer. You'll find pictures which purport to be shots of UFO, of Foo Fighters. Now, in the book, I've got two pictures. They're exactly the same, apart from in one, there's three lights. And the caption when you see it on the internet is, these are Foo Fighters with a group of B-17s. Well, the B-17s from the markings are from the 384th Bomb Group. They were based in East Anglia in Britain during the war. And you can find the original photograph, and it's got these lights don't appear on it. And there are other photographs which are exactly the same, where they've been doctored after the war. Now, to me, the Japanese pictures that have come up, there's a famous one that you'll see of this blob between two aircraft which have spattered undercarriages, the fixed undercarriages. And the types of aircraft, because people don't rarely look into what type of aircraft they are, because then you can pin down which kind of area they might be photographed in or what time frame. Now, these things are Takashi Kai-36s. They're an Army cooperation aircraft. They weren't that widespread across the Pacific. They mostly fought in the China campaign and some other parts of the Pacific, and in a much earlier part of the war, because they were quite obsolete later on. So you can pin down the time when that photograph might have been taken. And there are no Foo Fighter reports from that part of the world. So that picture could have just been a blob on the film or a defect in the developing. It could have been anything, really. It could have been a flak burst. There's no supporting documentation or evidence or testimony with these pictures. So you've got no idea whether they're true or not, never mind what they show. And I defy anybody to say that's definitely a Foo Fighter, because there's no way of proving it. They may well be, but chances are they're not. And there are no definite pictures of whether you're looking at Europe or whether you're looking at North Africa or the Pacific or the North Atlantic or wherever, of things that are Foo Fighters. Now, in the records, when you see some of these things, there are kind of references to photographs being taken, but the photographs never appear in the document in the official documentation in the historical records. So somewhere these photographs might appear, or they might have been hidden, or they might have been lost, or who knows? But some were taken.
And so, did anybody ever take the time to try and interview witnesses after the war?
Yes, there were people who did that, albeit not at the time. So Joe Chamberlain, who wrote that article for the American Legion in 1945, he took his information directly from pilots at the time. But then people who were writing about UFOs for quite a long time afterwards, so you're almost into sort of the late 80s, early 1990s, were just regurgitating these same stories from that article, with a few exceptions. There were some people who had actually got information into the likes of Flying Saucer Review in the 60s, and some other newsletters in the intervening years between sort of 50s and the 90s. but they're very few and far between these stories. So some pilots have come forward, some crews have come forward to say, we saw these things and here's a bit of information. Or UFO researchers had spoken to some of them and they passed information on. The Flying Saucer Review story is that case in point. 1962, they came up with a story, they actually published the story of that Polish crew who I mentioned before about them shooting at that light. And that's where that story comes from. And the actual pilot was interviewed. And if you look hard enough on the internet, you can find actually his interview and him speaking about what happened that night. So there are some stories. Now, when you get into the 1990s, there were people like Jeff Linsell and John Aldrich, who were American researchers. They were very interested in the kind of the nuts and bolts of the Foo Fighters story and the folklore side of it. And Jeff Linsell in particular, I believe, had actually interviewed quite a lot of people who were still alive back then, the American crews, that is, not just from the European side, but also from the Pacific side. And that information is, you know, it's out there, but it's not in a form where it's in a book. However, there was somebody called Keith Chester who wrote a book in 2007 called Strange Company. And that was the book that really opened my eyes as to, look, there is more information beyond what I knew already, those, you know, nine cases or so. And that's when I started thinking, look, there's much more to this and there must be more I can still find. But I wasn't in a position then to do anything about it until sort of last year when I started writing the book. But Keith Chester's book has a lot of testimony from pilots. So that was picked up by, you know, he'd actually talked to some people as well. And he was picking up on work that had been done by Jeff Linsell and also from Jan Aldrich from the Project 1947 website. So that was in his book as well. And that book's worth reading because it was a really great early stab at coming up with much more information about the Foo Fighters. And I've corresponded with Keith since then. And he agrees that there's some errors in that book because it was an early stab at trying to go beyond what was already said. And I've tried to put those errors right in my book because some of them were down to the types of aircraft or the years or the dates of or the names of the people involved of some of these cases. And I felt it was important to put the record straight because you don't want kind of things, your errors being perpetuated through into the future.
So I suppose at the end of the war, the fighting stopped. Did the Foo Fighter report stop as well? Is it like as soon as the fighting stopped, they were gone?
Yeah, well, that's the funny thing. The number of sightings fell off a cliff as soon as the war ended. It was actually, they were sort of petering out as you got into the end of April, before, you know, which just a few weeks before the end of the war. But of course, at that time, already American sort of technological, you know, gathering teams were scouring Germany. The British were doing it as well. The T forces and the Alsos team, who were looking for atomic secrets, they were scouring German industry, aeronautical industry, and other types of industry, looking for secrets, looking for things that they could use and they could bring back home and they could develop themselves. And there was, of course, there was a strand of thought that, well, they're looking for things that might account for the Foo Fighters. And that is true. They were looking for things, because they still had it in their mind that there was all these strange things that were happening and they couldn't work it out. And they're in sort of the summer, towards the early autumn of 1945, they'd managed to get a whole load of German scientists and some high-ranking Luftwaffe officials from the Air Defense Network. And there was 13 of them all together. And the Americans had them in captivity, and they actually questioned about the score called, well, they call them balls of fire. And this questionnaire was available. I found a copy of what they'd asked and the responses they got from these 13 individuals. And they knew nothing. They knew nothing of them at all. The only thing they could come close to was, and I'm not sure if you're aware of this thing, but it was called the Bachem Natter. And it was a vertical takeoff, a rocket-powered interceptor that the Germans built right at the end of the war. You're talking about the first flight being in March 1945. And it took off from a tower vertically. It could climb at about 30,000 feet. It had jettisonable rockets, and the whole thing broke up into three pits once it had completed its mission to parachute back to Earth. And it was a reusable weapon, effectively. But the idea was it would rocket off from this tower. It had a little volley of of air-to-air rocket, of unguided air-to-air rockets in its nose. It would fire those at a bomber stream, and then it would the pilot would pull a lever, the aircraft would disintegrate effectively, and he would parachute back to Earth. The engine part would parachute back to Earth, and the wings, the rest of it would do the same. And there was only one manned test flight. It involved the death of the pilot because something went wrong, and they never ever put it into service because they couldn't develop it enough in time. They actually had launchers set up on one day to attack a bomber stream, and they had the aircraft set ready and pilots trained to fly them, even though they never actually test flown them. And the American tanks got there before they could launch them, and the place was captured. This was a crazy program. It was one of these last-ditch desperation moves to try and defeat these streams of American bombers that were attacking American industry day after day after day. And one of these German scientists who was being quizzed about, well, what are these balls of fire, said, that's the only thing I can think it could be. But it couldn't have been that because, as I say, they never used them in anger.
Well, it's been great talking to you. The book's called UFOs Before Roswell, European Foo Fighters, 1940 to 1945. And that's on Kindle, isn't it? And paperback?
Yes, Kindle, paperback, and hardback. So you get it through Amazon. If you search for my name, you'll find it there. If you search through UFOs Before Roswell, you should find it.
And you have a website?
I have a website. If you look for me on the internet, you'll find it. You can look under Graham Rendell, your researcher, but also it's under realercountrybooks.com, so that's me.
Fantastic. And I'll put the links in the show notes so people can find the book and your website.
And yeah, and they can follow me on Twitter at Border750. That's the easiest way to get in touch with me. I accept direct messages, so unless people are asking me to marry them or asking me to give them money, then I tend not to respond.
Right. Well, thanks a lot for coming on the podcast. It's been fascinating.
You're welcome, Simon. Thanks very much for the invitation. I've really enjoyed it. Thank you.
And that was an interview with Graham Rendell about his book, UFOs Before Roswell, European Foo Fighters, 1940 to 1945. A great way to support the podcast is to sign up on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/alienufopodcast. This is the free 1 hour version of the episode. The extended episode is 1 hour and 19 minutes. If you join the $4.50 a month tier, you'll get an extended episode every month. If you join the $7.50 a month tier, you'll have access to an extended episode every week and the back catalogue of extended episodes. My website is pastliveshypnosis.co.uk, where you can find my other podcast. It's called the Past Lives Podcast. There are over 200 episodes, and it's where I look into evidence of the afterlife. In my work as a clinical hypnotherapist, I take people through past life regressions. And when you book a past life regression hypnosis session with me, and you have signed up to Patreon, you get a 25% discount. And I'm offering a free consultation call, which can be booked on my website. My Instagram is a past lives podcast with an underscore between each word. And on Twitter, I am at Simon G. Bown. If you enjoy the podcast, be sure to subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or via your favourite podcast app to make sure that you don't miss out on any episodes. And thanks for listening.